Lone Pine, California. June 15th, 1970. A discussion between Professor Günther Summers and Franklin Wolf.
But this is why, you know, you have now said twice that you tried in your tapes and so on to guard against this misinterpretation. Almost every doctrine has, where it has had base effects also.
Yeah, that's right. I know there's a Mephisto around. I know, I've met my own Mephisto. Mm-hmm. And just as Christ met his Satan. It was quite a wonderful experience in a way, and it was a close contest. But you never destroy him. All you can do is domesticate him and make him a cooperating power. But in the dualistic world, there is no such thing as a goodness that doesn't have its shadow, a darkness. How to deal with that duality is the critical problem. And the history of religion shows that the dark side, sooner or later, comes on top. It has in Christianity. Christianity has become a perversion of Christ. And much of Buddhism has become a perversion of Buddha.
One could say it's almost a systematic split between world and deed, the way it's now organized.
Yeah.
Almost no relationship between what is said on Sunday and what takes place
Monday. Well, now you've got to handle that problem. Since you cannot destroy Mephisto, since there can be no good in the relative sense without a corresponding evil, that even your good gets defined by its relationship to that evil, you've got to get a valid working relationship between the two poles. It complicates your problem enormously. Now there is the higher good, which is the integration of the relative good and evil into a something else, where the evil is transformed into something that is no longer evil. And the good is transformed into something which is no longer the old good. And they both become something superior, which you might call, if you please, a higher good, but just because we don't have adequate terms for it. It's unfortunate. There's another term needed. We haven't got adequate language for expressing these things. But that is a fact. Now, you cannot say, I will have nothing to do with that dark side of myself. All you do is to put blinders on your eyes, and that dark side is going to manifest without your knowing it on the community. The community will see you as dark then, if you put blinders on yourself. And your good intentions become turned into something sour. You've got to recognize that, Paul, that he is part of you. You've got to recognize that Christ is not lone Christ. He's Christ Satan. He's both combined. But Satan is behind. Satan no longer leads after the temptation. He said, get thee behind me. In other words, he is that which gives a third dimension to the ideal of the Christ and makes it a living power. Without Satan, it would be an empty ideal. There. Now, that's heresy with a vengeance. But I know from a traditional point of view, it's heresy.
We'll get the faggots ready. Everybody got a light?
This is religion and philosophy. You can't separate them. What is the difference between philosophy and separation from religion and religion? Philosophy is the ideation, completed as far as possible, without action. When it becomes commitment of my life, then it's religion, mm-hmm. combined with the philosophy. Mm-hmm.
It's an experiencing of what we think.
Not only experience, but doing.
And doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I don't regard pure secular philosophy as enough, nor do I regard this sentimental religiosity as enough. But the integration of the two, yes, that's bringing. Now, of course, in this book, there are the three facets, only one of which is emphasized here, because that's the purpose of this book. There is cognition, there is affection, and there is commation. Cognition includes the reason, organization, all ideation, all knowing. But affection includes all of the feeling aspect of man. That's, of course, the term for it. All of the feeling includes the ananda, the joy, experience of joy, and so on. Something which Aurobindo has pointed out is neglected in Western philosophy. And third, cognition includes will, doing, power, and all of that side. The power of effectuation. Those three facets are involved in fundamental realization. They're all affected. An enormous delight, an enormous sense of a formless knowledge. You can labor a lifetime to try to give it form in idea. There's no end to it. And then a power that dwarfs the powers of the Caesar, because it's a power that works in the very unconscious that makes it possible for a Caesar to exist. It could be used to undermine every Caesar that there is. If one, but that would be a devilish thing to do. You have no right to break the law that way. But power is there. Now, religion, as Aurobindo has pointed out, heretofore has attempted only to deal with love and knowledge. Love corresponding to affection, feeling, and so on. The whole devotional side, and knowledge. Both of these are naturally pure. They don't pose difficult problems. Religion has avoided the power problem because power becomes corrupted so easily. Yet, as he points out, and I agree with him fully on this, religion must tackle the power problem, redeem it, domesticate it, because you are ineffective without power.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of a little book by Paul Tillich. I don't know if you ever heard of him. Paul Tillich.
I think I've heard the name.
A little book, well, he was from Germany. He was the first professor who was thrown out by the Nazis in 1933. And then two of your theologians here in the U.S., Richard and Reinhold Niebuhr, who were then at Union Theological Seminary, invited him over. And so he came over here in 1933. And he wrote, among many other things, I knew him personally, and in my dissertation I also deal with his work and show the influences of Schelling upon him.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a little book called Love, Power, and Justice, you know, where he tries to point out that we usually have either power or we have love without power, and so on. You have this always separated. And when you spoke, I also thought of many an administrator and people that I've met. They say to me, power is the farthest from my mind. You know, when they continuously execute power, but they live in this illusion that power plays no role in any form. They
power,
see power as something dirty per se, you know, and then they very often execute it in a very repressive way without even knowing it.
Power is necessary if you're going to have effectuation. Otherwise, you're just dealing with ideas and beautiful sentiments. But they're not effective without power. So, never despise the principle that Schopenhauer emphasized, namely the will, which is the power principle. But it needs domestication. It needs to be transformed. It needs to become a servant rather than something that feeds the ego. Now, to deal with power and not to be face the egotistical temptation is about as strong a test as any man can have. But there have to be those among this humanity who have the courage to tackle the problem of power, face the temptation, and hopefully master, so they can wield power without being great egos. But this world cannot be redeemed without power. And I might say, be so comfortable to go the path of love or the path of knowledge, the wonderful delights of it, that you leave this world in turmoil, in a state of suffering, as Buddha said, a state of ignorance, as Shankara said, a state of perverse will, as the Christians put it. And shall I be saved and they be damned? That muddy out there, that means you've got to be willing to take and use the power necessary to be effective. Now, it can be subtle power. It can be a power that's not visible to the crude sight, but it can be a power that's transforming the whole orientation of humanity. Now that is the approach to solving the wrongness in the world that can be effective. All of every other method the world has tried has failed, been ineffective. Spiritual power must be part of it. And one may fall. One might go into nirvana and be perfectly safe there if he doesn't tackle it. If he goes out in that world, he faces the danger of the fall away from hubris, as you might call, or inflation, but have the courage to face that danger. Hopefully, meeting it successfully. Now, we need people. They'll play that part. It's not a soft game. It's a dangerous game.
And usually we, go the sentimental way, and then the repressive power is completely left to those who have no knowledge.
All right.
And no skills.
That's what happens.
And then
the dark ones then take over. I had a little problem here. Approaching our convention Sunday last year. And I had planned a rather especially important talk. And there were some people here. I wanted everyone present. They had a threat of a family breakup. Both of them were close to me. As a man had his wife and his daughter. He told them, take the car and their stuff and get out. Well, they packed it in the car and they came up here. And I took the problem on. I saw what it was. And what they were doing was trying to undermine what I was trying to do. That they were the playthings of another force that is antagonistic. Now, what is it doing? It is trying to break up, separate, and so forth. All right, I'll use the opposite tactic and take a circle and pull them all in. I don't need to be afraid of this black side. I know my own Mephisto, and he's a pretty keen fellow. And I could put him on the job, too, and I'd better get be careful by James to me. So I sent Gene down to get this man up. I talked to him, I told him what was involved, and I said, I want you to stay here handle this problem, postpone it, and so to be present at the meeting next Sunday. There was another possible source that there might be something negative coming in. Had that person come in too. We had a very comfortable time with them. Now, my point was, I wasn't going to be afraid of a negative thing. I said, they'd better be afraid of me. He didn't trouble us. Now, that was a power play on a psychical level. We had a peaceful thought. Now, it wasn't power with guns or material forces, but it was power that was dealing with psychical forces. And I wasn't humble in the situation. I said, now here, I'll take command of this. It worked. Well, now, these young people have got, can't despise that, or they'll be ineffective litter cast off by society and produce no effect. Now, I don't underestimate the value of affection either. That comes into the picture. And of all sorts of gentleness.
Could I, you mentioned earlier this edition of Plato's works, that I would like to send you, if I may.
I'd be delighted.
And maybe also that little silly thing, Love, Power, and Justice.
Yeah.
It's a very small one.
Is this the one that has the seven letters in it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I want.
Letters with letter seven.
That's the one I want.
And I would like to do that.
I would very much appreciate it. I was thinking I wanted that. I wanted to get that letter. That's something from Plato I haven't seen.
A while ago, I thought of another passage in Plato where there was that. It's in the Republic in book 6. It's just before you get to the cave, which is at the beginning of book 7. And there he speaks of, we were talking about the Godhead, using Meister Eckhart's term, the God which surpasses the God, which is the opposite of the dark and of the
evil,
where the two are correlated, and where the dark is the, you could say, the energy within the Godhead. I think Plato came at least this place in his own way close to this insight. He writes of the form, he tries to describe the agathon, the good, which he uses in the Republic in the place of God. He tries to describe it as that which surpasses all forms and all beings.
Mm-hmm.
It is actually no longer form. You have earlier talked of the formlessness in this case, but it is not a chaotic formlessness.
No.
So he speaks there of the agathon, the good, surpassing all usia, which would be all essence, and all idea or eidos, which would be all form.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, of course, no longer sees it then as a form along form. He no longer sees it in the dualism of cosmos and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think hints are there for a long, long time before something can be manifest itself and can be more adequately formulated. And we probably have to develop our language. Our language is still inadequate.
Oh, yes. I found that. I got a lot of help from mathematics for expressing some ideas.
But there are times when you just, even our grammatical form is inadequate. You can't say it in our grammar. For instance, we have, just in your present tense, past tense, and future tense, there's no tense for timelessness. You use is, perhaps, but that's really present tense. Timelessness isn't just present.
There's also this problem that some of our languages are more impoverished than the Greek language was. They have two terms for time, chronos, which is quantitative time, and kairos, K-A-I-R-O-S, which is qualitative time, or which is time of meaning, unique time, which is, or they also have the term for beginning, arche, which is not chronological beginning, which is arche, in the sense of that which is forever present, as I mean, some existentialists have tried to capture it by saying looking at each day as if for the first time, which is beginning in the sense of a continuous renewal or regenerative process. And even that, I mean, you need then so much circumscription simply because we do not have the precise terms now.
Yes.
And of course, our languages have been now for centuries shaped primarily by the marketplace, by the realm of having,
yes,
rather than by the realm of being.
Okay, just come on over.
Yes.
Being good night.
No, I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay.
Oh,
yes, I have
see you.
To. You know, I have to ask you.
Yes, I know. I'll tell you all about it tomorrow.
When do you want us to be up?
6 o'clock.
Have you talked about it?
Yes. He said, oh yeah, he was there last night and he wants to go.
Where?
At Mrs. Willow's.
Yeah? Something very strange came up just before we came up. We talked with Peggy. And I said, I'm so fascinated by what has happened to me here, the landscape and the people, and also Eva said to me, don't just start something, you know, pursue it further. And so I said to Peggy, is there no job anywhere here? Is there no opportunity? Maybe I should take a year out and do more manual work. Until I find the right transition to the next life. And she said there is this lady who is looking for someone to look after her nut trees primarily and do...
Mrs. Willard. She is a person that should not. She's too old. She should not live alone. And
yeah.
It's a beautiful place in the Alabama's down there.
And I have worked until I was 16 in my grandfather's farm, primarily orchards, picking apples and
pears. Well, they have a nice orchard down there. They have their own system of water. They have a caretaker's house. Then she has an independent house for a library. She has a guest house beside her own house. She has a kohler plant. And it's a cup in the Alabama hills there. It keeps warm enough in winter so that the almonds can actually set, which would be impossible up here. Apricots set down there. I think that cup would be pretty warm in summer, but it'd be very mild in winter. It's a kind of a cup in the hills.
Do you think I could master it without becoming the complete slave of it? I need at least 2 days a week to write and study.
I think so. You talk to her about it. Well, yes, if you want to do that, go down and see her. She certainly is in need. I told, last time I saw her, I said, are you alone? She said, yes. I said, you shouldn't be. When we get old, our bones get brittle, you fall, and you could have a bad time before anybody come around. I know people are getting up in the 70s and 80s. It shouldn't be entirely alone.
Well, Jean just said, oh, that's a lot of work, you know, and I should probably, you know, you have to cut out.
There is work, but it's not. But as she is, nothing's being done.
Mm-hmm.
The place is in pretty good shape. A nice beaver down saw it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ingrid really would come on the condition that she can find a good choir in the area, which she could either direct or sing in that piece, or both.
I take any little church choir, so that I can continue in my what I want to do, because I would take a year out for not going to college, you know, and I believe in.
Yeah. And you would study mathematics on the Dr. Wolf.
Oh, the poor man, no!
I'm focusing everything on what can bear on this.
Yeah.
You see, I'm pretty near 83. I will be next month. Energy is not what they once were.
Right.
And, by the way, we're getting down, I see.
You can always erase it.
What I, your suggestion of writing, what your reaction to this, I would very much like it.
I would love to make a critical study of Fowler's, Schelling's work in this area and yours. I'm sure this would be fascinating to me and would also contribute to my own growth, so it would be a good experience for me. And if I have done something, I would show it to you, and if it's not good, I will work some more, and if it's useless, then please tell me.
No, it won't be useless. I know enough about you already. And furthermore, it's not for me to I'm having trouble with the word censor anything, because when I'm no longer alive, I can't censor. It's a matter of what is the reaction of this going to be on people. They have a right to be themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And many, many reactions I haven't foreseen, which I would approve of, so far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
There might be some of which I could not approve, which would be a perversion and so forth.
Well, it would also be helpful to me. I am at this, you know, I gave you a little sketch of what I've been involved in, and I'm present there, hopefully that I can be a teacher there in some of these situations. But I also realize in myself that running into a lot of stupidity directly, you know, not only this or that police lieutenant who makes stupid psychological mistakes and this and that, but also police chiefs who say, when you ask them why, then they say, because I said so, you know. I mean, stuff like this makes me unnecessarily impatient. I just wonder whether I would not, where I would end up. My training, I must not forget, until I was 16, was in Nazi Germany, and I was trained to be a killer.
Mm-hmm.
And though I remained highly idealistic, and there was the influence of a profoundly religious father and mother, but nevertheless, there, you know, there was that phase. And when a colleague of mine, of course, I see it when somebody else says it. A colleague of mine, who is a professor of education, has been a soldier and flyer for 13 years, said, "You might better watch," he said to some students. "I might become a killer again just like that." No. And then I snapped. I said, "There are also killers of soul." No, I mean, if you can become a killer like that, just like that, then maybe you are already one. In the sense of why it is a soul murderer. You know, when he says many a professor should be prosecuted for soul murder, for motivation destruction and interest, destruction of interest. But nevertheless, I sense in myself, it was very helpful to me what you said about power.
Mm.
Because in many ways, Nazism, I think, was very sentimental. You know, people have the wrong notion when they say no kind of art or music. It was a lot of, quote, poetry and song and music, but it was always of the sentimental variety. And then, of course, bombasticism played a great role in the appearances. And then, on the other hand, the cold-hearted indifference of another kind, which corresponds to sentimentalism. And so what you said about power and affection and love and
knowledge,
and this being fearless in the face of it and also facing it, this is very important for me. So, but beyond this, whenever I write something and you detect something, you do me a service. It's just like if you are the dentist and you do not get the black out, close it up too. You know, I mean, you are still around. So if I write something, even if you would feel that I would get mad or hurt, that is not the point.
I was one of my saboteurs. That's April we were in Phoenix. He had written up some of my ideas connected with the conception of consciousness without an object. His impression on me was that he made very obscure something I thought was very simple. But I said, that's perfectly all right.
And
that helps
you. And long German words, that long.
But I said,
Nietzsche once said, many of us, all we do is stir up shallow water, you know, and stir it up to make it muddy so you think it's very deep.
He's thinking about the possibility of taking over the caretaker's job down at Mrs. Willard.
I know, I think that'd be wonderful.
I'd be jealous.
He is really looking.
He has to find a choir and...
wants a couple of days, you see, for his own work. I think she would meet that condition. She really very much needs a person. And I think she'd understand it. She's rather an understanding person. She is a student herself.
If I would have Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I don't know. But I don't want to get rusty either.
No.
In the head. But if I could find this combination, this would be. I think this would be a good.
I think so.
Experience.
Well, I tell you what. Now you're going over to Paradise starting tomorrow. You could make it, I guess, in one day, all right. And then you could come back and occupy the little house, the ranch house, during the interim when you're trying to get oriented down for a job or something.
Well, we thought we briefly see her in the morning. This is what Piggy suggested, and Jean evidently is willing to show us the way. And did he say he would go over with us?
He probably will.
Yeah, I said to him, he said he just has been over there last night. Then you don't want to go over.
That we do not to, plan on something which we haven't seen. We would like to get somewhat of a, I don't want to cheat the person either.
Oh no, you should see it first.
It's something I can't do, I can't master somewhat.
Oh goodness. You could master that.
And now Ingrid would want to find a choir, and Miss Eaton said that most likely she could take piano with her friend Irene.
Irene, yeah.
Marek.
We have brought her once, and Ingrid thinks we are highly.
Oh, I think. Well, we have a recording.
Mm-hmm. And so
just these big hands, and she just plays these little things, I just marvel.
She's a very sensitive.
Yes.
So I had suddenly a very good feeling about this when this came out tonight, so then of course I could disturb you some more too.
I've enjoyed this contact with you. It's mutual there. Furthermore, you're bringing out that point about Schelling, a certain fellow of spirit that I didn't know what he was meant a good deal to me.
Even in language, your language is almost identical.
Of all things.
In different forms. and so on.
That's interesting. You know,
they are not translated, that's the problem. This is what I must complete, this one little work, and earlier ones I started his History of Modern Philosophy, which is the cross criticism of the modern period, where he sits in with Descartes and the Cogito Ergo Sum, and goes all the way down to Hegel. And yet I never completed that either, because when you teach 12 hours a week and then I was chairman of the department, and there's so many administrative sessions and meetings, you use a lot of your vital energy for unnecessary stuff.
That's why this Dr. Reinel dropped the administrative work. He was the head of the department. He didn't want to bother with it anymore, so he dropped it. Mm-hmm. He's probably their best man. Well, I appreciated that, what you brought out about Schelling. I want to make this point. An experience like the high indifference is like having a secret. Not because you won't express it, but because you can't really communicate it. Only partially can you communicate it. And therefore, you're living with a secret that gives you a loneliness. Until I found the similarity to Buddha, it was pretty strong and wasn't very pleasant. But gradually, when you find that the same thing has been emerging, it doesn't matter if it's 2,000, 2,500 years ago or any period ago. It doesn't have to be somebody who's living today. You feel you have a community that you belong to. And to add somebody like Schelling would be quite an addition. Jung tells of that experience. He had the period of confrontation with the unconscious for several years. He said at times it was like hot lava flowing over him. Even though he was doing well in his professional work and had a reputation, he was oppressed by these experiences that are flooding in on him. Among the figures that arose in the dream was first the figure of Elijah, and then later it transformed into the layman, who acted as a guru, as a spiritual teacher, gave instructions and so forth. Well, we didn't know whether it happened to anybody else in the world. Finally, he met a Hindu, and an educated Hindu, and he asked the Hindu about their guru chela form of education, connection with yoga, and the Hindu said, quite matter-of-factly, "Oh, my guru is Sri Shankaracharya." Young was astonished. He says, "You mean the man who made commentaries on the Vedas hundreds of years ago?" "Yes, the same. Yeah, he's a spiritual guru. Most people have a living guru, but some have a spiritual guru like that." And then Jung thought about his philemon. He said, "I realized I hadn't dropped out of the human race." So he was in a very lonely state. He's having experiences he didn't know anybody else ever.
Well, it takes incredible energy and power to bear something alone. Because there are all these learned people around you and do not write about it, do not see it. And I could imagine that one would have moments of doubting one's sanity even.
Well, you could. If you see, you have a solitary experience. You look for those that might have something similar. You have a very clear assurance at the time, during the lucid interval. The assurance is very powerful. but you're only in a lucid interval a relatively brief time, a matter of hours perhaps, but not continuously. There are energies involved such that the organism couldn't stand it, as a matter of fact. And then you're out of it, and then questions come into your mind. Well, have I understood this correctly? And so on.
I've always this problem with this light there to listen and to follow you.
Excuse me.
Takes a great deal of concentration, and your eyes are strong. And then the light, thank you very much.
We're going to have to get our lighting revamped here.
Well, it's only maybe my... I'm extremely sensitive to light.
No, well, I most have people been object to these lights here. I need to make a change in it.
And it doesn't bother me when I'm not involved in something that demands a great deal, but when it demands, and then especially when I have the neon lights above me, and it's a very demanding exchange, then these lights get too much for me.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that could be out. Just speak any time. By the way, since you're going in the morning, maybe we'd better take up the practical, mundane affair of going there and see what the best way is to go. Yeah.
You know, what we thought of maybe doing is go over to the coast and then go up.
We would like to take maybe 2 days. Roger, who was here Sunday, today described to us a route which made very
good sense.
I have it written down in my notebook.
Well, now let me get some of our larger scale maps.
So we have this down. The only question.
You didn't bring the California map.
No, only this one.
Yeah, well, we have another one too that is more detailed.